I would like to start by, first of all, thanking the organizers of the conference and the Collège de France for inviting me to participate in this conference and for their very generous hospitality in these 2 days. I will try and summarize some of the botanical remains from excavations in the Eastern Desert, and particularly in relation to the food supply. Just to set the scene, because of the desert location, there is effectively no agricultural production of food in the immediate vicinity, so all of the food has to be brought for some considerable distance, and in antiquity, the supply route would be approximately 1 week to several of the sites I'll be talking about, and some of the sites even longer. And we need to consider both food and water for not just for all the people working in these various sites, but also for the working animals. And as we've already heard in some of the other talks, at some of these sites, the number of people working is very, very high indeed. Like, for example, in Mons Claudianus, we're talking of 900 or more people at any one time. So we're looking at a very complex logistical problem to be solved. And so the first very, very basic questions we might want to ask is, what did people actually eat in terms of plant food? How varied was the diet? Was the diet limited because of the long supply routes? Can we see differences between the different types of sites that have been studied so far? And what do the food remains tell us about society more widely? There are currently 10 sites with botanical remains excavated over the last 25 years. And I'm focusing for this particular talk the sites with material from the 1st to the 3rd century AD. I don't have time to look at the earlier and the later remains today. So we have three categories of sites. We have two ports, Berenike and Mias Hormos. We have four quarry sites, Mons Claudianus, Mons Porphyritus, Tiberiane, and Cana Latomia. And we have four way stations, Badian, associated closely with the Mons Porphyritus complex, Maximianon on the route to Mias Hormos, and Xeron and Didymoi on the route to Berenike. And just to remind you briefly of the location with the quarry complexes in the northern part of the region, we have here the two ports, and then here the four way stations. The material is put together by a lot of different people. Five of the sites I have studied myself, but Berenike was done with my colleague René Kappers and published in 2006. And we have Didymoi, published by Margarethe Tenberg in 2011. And then we have three sites that are currently unpublished, one worked on by Charlène Bouchot, who will be speaking in a minute, and two further sites worked on by Claire Newton. And I'm very grateful to them for giving me the unpublished raw data to help me summarize this paper. One of the huge advantages of working in the Eastern Desert is that the very arid conditions here mean that preservation of botanical remains is excellent. And here I've summarized the number of food plants found at each of the sites, both desiccated in yellow and in dark gray, carbonized. Carbonized preservation of botanical remains is what we commonly find in Northwest Europe and also large parts of North Africa and the Middle East. Desiccated preservation is quite rare, but Egypt is one of the key locations where we can find such remains. And you can see that desiccated preservation means that we get information about many, many more plant foods than we would know about if we didn't have that desiccated material. Just to give you an example of the quality of the preservation, here we have the bracts of artichoke, I think you can almost see the teeth marks of the Romans who have been eating these artichokes, and we see here the cloves of garlic. They look so fresh you could use them tonight in your cooking your dinner. And we find here these base plates of garlic. So the preservation is incredibly high, which also meant we find material like vegetative parts of plants that would in carbonized material never be preserved. Now, what, as archaeobotanists, what do we normally find? Well, normally we would find those parts of the plants that are not edible. So we find the seeds of fruits, we find the shells of nuts, we find the outer skin and the roots of onion, for example. These are remains that people would have discarded in the preparation of food. But of course, we also find the actual food remains, normally in much smaller quantities, and largely because these were remains that have been accidentally lost. And that's something to sort of keep in mind always when we try and interpret the results, that the actual number of remains of a particular food plant does not necessarily give any realistic indication of their importance in the diet. Across the 10 sites that have been studied for this period, we find very, very consistent patterning. And I've listed here some 18 food plants that we find effectively in all of these sites. And as that will indicate straight away, is that we are not dealing with a particularly restricted diet in terms of the plants. This is a very respectable range of foods, giving both carbohydrates for energy, giving fruits and which provide various vitamins. It includes also flavorings that are important in terms of making foods more interesting, but also plants that may have medicinal roles. So we find really very balanced diet across all of these sites and a lot of common patterning in them. But one of the interesting things across all the sites is that if we look at the two most common, numerically most common food remains that we find a lot of grain of barley. And here I've indicated on the graph the relative proportion of barley grain versus wheat grain on each of these sites. Where the information for a particular site is not available, it is because the publication, doesn't give enough detail for me to do these calculations. And you can see that consistently, the grains of barley are much, much more dominant than those of barley, which you might think is unusual because it's mostly the wheat that people are eating. And I'll show you in a minute. The other most common material we find across all the sites is the chaff of wheat. And what I think these two elements represent is in fact the fodder for the working animals. And the reason we find that large amount of quantity of material is that they are what I would refer to as messy eaters. They're not concerned about a certain amount of waste, while I think most of the people on site will be very careful to use all the foods that's been where there's been so much effort bringing it to the site that it's actually consumed. And even today, the grains of barley, the chaff of wheat, as well as some green fodder, is the standard feed for both donkeys and camels. And some evidence corroborating this interpretation is that if we look at the dung of these animals, we can find the grains of barley embedded, sometimes not actually digested at all, as well as the chaff of wheat. We very commonly find that still present in the dung. And so in terms of thinking about the quantity of material, if we think about the number of working animals that were used to transport all the food, to transport the products that were imported from the ports, as well as transporting the stone, we're talking about very, very large numbers of animals, and therefore very large quantities of animal food that has to be shipped across the desert. An interesting other component of the assemblages is that we find vegetables, green vegetables, and what we are finding is the seeds of these vegetables. And but these are green vegetables where we would not eat the seeds, but we would actually eat the green leaves. So the question was, when I started finding these, you know, why do we find the seeds? Because we find seeds of vegetables usually in two possible situations. First of all, in locations where we're growing vegetables, where we use the seeds to sow the plants. And we also find them in a situation of growing vegetables where accidentally the plants have bolted and the plant has started to flower and set seed. And at that point, of course, the leaves, etc., become pretty well inedible. So this may actually help us interpret these results, in that I think what's happening is that we see in the desert the growing of vegetables to ensure a fresh supply of these green vegetables, that the long supply routes would mean these types of vegetables would not survive in the heat. And here a list of the range of vegetables that I think could have been grown in the desert at various locations. And you can see the, you know, consistently huge presence of them, especially in the quarry sites. That's where the largest number occur, but in others as well. And interestingly, there's a lot of corroboration of this interpretation from the Ostraca, for example, from the Ostraca Mons Claudianus, published by Adam Buller-Jakobsen and Wilfried van Rengen. We have several mentions of a garden, of seeds, of the growing of vegetables and the delivery to various locations of bunches of vegetables, and the same vegetables as we find in the botanical remains, such as cabbage, lettuce, beets, chicory, etc. So here the suggestion that not just do we get food delivered from the Nile Valley to the various sites, but there's clearly also a lot of effort spent on growing some additional foods that really require to be fresh, to be produced in the desert itself. Now we have two ports involved with the eastern trade, so it's worth looking at the range of spices that come from the east and where we may find those. And just to start off with the next, I don't know whether you would identify this for me. Yeah, Clou de girofle, yeah? Well, this is just an illustration why it's important that the people doing this type of work have spent a lot of time checking their identifications, checking reference material, because unfortunately it's actually myrt rather than myrtle, rather than... when we first found this, we were so excited, thinking the first evidence of clove actually in most of the Western world. Fortunately, we didn't immediately rush into press, but decided to check our reference collections and spend a lot of time studying the botanical composition. They are very closely related. They're in the same plant family, but there are clear differences. So just a note of warning. Here we have the table with the imports from the Indian subcontinent that were found on the sites we've studied. And you can see that the two ports, Berenike and Myos Hormos, have by far the most evidence. But even so, the evidence, it's not a great deal. We have black pepper in large quantity. We have a certain amount of rice. and we have quite a lot of coconut. But for the rest, the quantities are quite small, even though we know that in the Roman period there was trade in other spices. They are not found on the excavations we've studied, which does not mean to say that they were not traded. What it means is they are so precious, they are so expensive, that it's not possible for any of the people working on these sites to have access to these plants. And pepper is the only one where maybe a certain amount was consumed on the sites, but mostly we think it's accidental spillage in the transshipment from the ships onto the caravan to bring it to the Nile Valley. And we find very small numbers of these imports in the other sites. So we have one or two grains of pepper from Mons Claudianus. We have one grain of rice in Didymoi. We have one segment of coconut in Xeron. And we have one or two of these Mirabolan, which are like medicinal plants. Very, very small quantities, indicating, again, almost certainly accidental spillage rather than specific local consumption. So indicating how expensive these spices were and not really available to the people working on these sites. Now, up to now, I've looked at, you know, a lot of common patterns between the various sites here. Just looking at the number of food plants at each of them, you can see a very consistent pattern in terms that the range of plants is present just about everywhere. But there are huge differences in the total number and therefore the variety of food available between the sites, so that the two ports and two of the quarries have almost doubled the number of food remains as the other, as the way stations, as the other two quarries. Now, there's an element where this may be explained by the amount of excavation, the amount of sampling, etc. But I think there's more going on, because if we look at what we find here in terms of foods that we don't find here, they're all plants that actually are extras. They're things that are over and above a basic staple diet, a healthy staple diet. They're all what you might even call luxuries, which I think are available to members of the society, and in this case, officers of higher rank, who clearly can afford to arrange for additional foods to be brought in that make their lives much more interesting and pleasant. And these are foods that would not be available to the entire population of each of the sites. So we have nuts in particular, I find almost primarily on those four sites, but also certain types of fruits that would have been quite rare even in the Nile Valley, quite a huge range of different herbs or spices that are used to flavor and create variety, and a number of these additional vegetables. So what I think is happening is that what the food remains indicate is that on these four sites, there is the presence of people of senior position, higher class officers. And at these two quarry sites, while they're quarry sites, they're actually small scale operations, and the evidence would suggest that these did not have these higher officers resident at those locations, and that therefore the basic diet is what's represented here, and these are the extras for certain individuals. We can also look at spatial patterning of certain foods across the site, and I've chosen the example here of Myos Hormos, where I've plotted using correspondence analysis where particular types of foods are found, and I've tried to categorize plants into certain groups. So, for example, we have the plants that are primarily interpreted as being fodder plants. We have, in this part of the graph, we have foods that I refer to as snack foods, things you can eat without cooking. You may have as you know, some food you eat in a break you have during your work, as well as imports, such as, for example, the black pepper. And in this part of the graph, we have foods that are commonly associated with preparation of your daily meal, such as the remains of the garlic and the onion, etc. And if we look at the location of where these groups of plants are found, we see that there are spatial variation in where we find certain plants. So the fodder plants are in particular trenches across the site here, and the imports and the snack foods are in another trench, and the evidence for food preparation and consumption is yet again in another series of trenches. And here that's the location, so that this area here, immediately adjacent to the harbour, is where the transshipment of the all the goods coming from India are put onto the caravan. So this is where people are working. And so this is actually where we find some of the pepper, some of the rice, suggesting their accidental spillage during transshipment, as well as some of these snack foods when people are having just something to eat in between working, while the evidence for food preparation is in this part of the site, a much more sort of domestic, residential part. So to summarize, we see a system that's a food supply that's very well organized, it's very consistent across the board. At all the sites, there's evidence of a good, varied diet. There's evidence of both food and fodder. And we see evidence of both the central supply of the basic staples, the basic diet, but also private enterprise in terms of the vegetables and the extra luxuries that are coming in through different means. We see evidence of higher ranked officials having access to these luxuries. And the whole system suggests that the supply of food is incredibly well organized, highlighting that the spice trade and the quarrying of the stone were very important to the empire, and therefore a lot of effort was put into this organization of food supply. The story doesn't quite end here. I'll take you a little bit beyond the Roman period. At Myos Hormos, we had the great fortune of finding remains both of the Roman period, but also of the Islamic period. And I'm talking here of the 11th to 13th century. There's no time to talk about the later Islamic period as well. So I just want to see quite, you know, what happens after the Roman period. And here, this was the slide I showed you earlier, with the four sites having substantially more food variety than the others. But here, look at Qusair in the 11th century. You know, it's gone way up again. So an enormous increase in range of foods. And if we look at what that range includes, well, we now start to find many more of the eastern spices, ginger, cardamom, turmeric. And not only do we find them in locations related to the trade, but we also start finding them in contexts that are very clearly domestic and are related to food preparation. So we now start to see evidence that people in the port during the Islamic period are also eating these spices, suggesting that they have become more common, less expensive, and are more widely available. And here to just compare again the Roman sites, that I showed, the slide that I showed you earlier, but then all the additional imports from the Indian continent that we start finding in the Islamic period. And in addition to spices, we now start also to find food plants that are equally originating from South and Southeast Asia. For example, we see the first evidence of sugarcane. We see the remains of aubergine. We start seeing different types of citrus plants. And here again, just the modern lime and the Islamic ones. And again, the nice thing about these desiccated botanical remains is you can actually almost see people preparing the food. I mean, I think you can just see how somebody has squeezed the juice out to make a fresh, nice drink. And somebody in the kitchen has cut off the calyx before preparing the aubergine for dinner. And we even find banana. And you may wonder, you know, how on earth do you know for certain that these brown bits of vegetable tissue are actually banana? Well, this little beauty has been absolutely critical in being able to prove this for certain, because that little tip here is this tip here. And if you can see this part here and then that part, are these parts at the base of, or the top, depending on how you want to look at it, of the banana. And the interesting thing is that on this archaeological example, we have part of the flower still attached to the banana, while usually when we buy bananas today, that part has come off, so suggesting this might be slightly immature when it was harvested. So here again to show you the range of other food plants coming from the Indian Ocean, and that we find very little evidence of that in the Roman period, but then the full range present in the Islamic period, suggesting this enormous change that's taking place at that point. So to summarize, you know, in many ways, we can see that the food choices of those working in the Eastern Desert as expressions of identity. Despite working in a remote part of the empire, or, as I now think more likely, because of working in a remote part of the empire, the choice of food was very strongly focused on Roman foods, that is, on foods widely available in the Mediterranean and the core of the empire. Eastern spices hardly featured, probably because of their expense, and partly because spices, with the exception of black pepper, were just a minor component of Roman cuisine. Spices were primarily used for other purposes. In contrast, by the Islamic period, Egypt and the Eastern Desert had become part of the Islamic world. People had embraced many of the Eastern spices and other Eastern foodstuffs, and several Mediterranean foods had actually been dropped. They had started to adopt food ways more characteristic of parts of the Middle East. Now, importantly, we should regard these changes in diet, in agriculture, and in trade not as passive outcomes or passive consequences of geopolitical transformations, because food ways are not merely a reflection of certain identities. Instead, foodways are integral parts of making those transformations and identities real. What it is to be part of the Roman Empire is connected to food practices, to the daily routines of procuring, growing, and consuming foods. These identities are created and maintained in part through food. So people working in the Eastern Desert in the Roman period expressed their identity as being part of the Roman Empire, being part of its cultural and economic sphere. During the Islamic period, the focus had moved east towards the Islamic world and the Indian Ocean. Thus, the changes that we see in the archaeobotanical record are part of the geopolitical realignment of the Red Sea region at this time. This was not just a political reality, it was a reality of everyday life. And this therefore highlights the importance of food in the dynamics of identity and geopolitics. Thank you.